Welcome to Searching for the Question. My name is David Orban, and I am very excited for today's episode. At the beginning of the 90s, I was, in love with Silicon Valley, but with San Francisco especially. And whenever I would be in the city, I would visit the City Lights bookstore. And obviously, it has a fantastic and very famous ambience, and all kinds of crooks and the little niches. The science fiction section of the bookstore is great. There is a almost hidden poetry room at the in the top, and surprisingly, its magazine section is also stimulating and interesting. And I know, actually, it was January 1990 when in the magazine section of the City Lights bookstore in San Francisco, I discovered Mondo 2000, a fantastic, crazy cyberpunk magazine precursor to what would be in a much more diluted mass appeal way, Wired magazine. Years later, it was a blast. And that is why I am so excited now to have as a guest the founder and editor of Mondo 2000. Are you serious? Are you welcome to the show?
Hello, everybody.
So as we chatted with Are You, he told me about his current projects, especially the Mondo 2000 history project is very interesting. The book that he's also working on. But he's so creative and multifaceted. There is also a new album, a series of songs. So we decided we will do it all. We will talk about a little bit the history of Mondo 2000, the history of the book that he's publishing. And are you you are also going to give us a gift by reading an excerpt of from your book. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Shall I start with that?
Why don't you start? You told me that there is also a little bit of story about a book.
Oh, yes. Okay, so the book was picked up by a book company called Zero Books. I should precede this maybe by saying that I had a record that was going to come out on from a record company called Nothing Records, run by Trent Reznor, and nothing was released. So now I had a book that was going to be with Zero Books, and zero happened. My continued luck. I have the theory in terms of trying to do some NFTs that if I ever made $1 million, capitalism itself would collapse. But, you know, I'm not complaining. Born under a bad sign or whatever, but I've got the rock and roll spirit. So
absolutely.
So there you go. So yeah, Zero Books, the person who was the acting publisher, who was a big enthusiast for my work, was released just as the book was in process. So now it's back on sale again through a representative, and it's stalled once again. The name of the book is The Freaks in the Machine, Mondo 2000. In 20th century tech culture. So
please go ahead, read us
the excerpt. So I'm going to read from an early part of the book, and it's called Chapter Zero, The Big Picture.
Go ahead.
Utopian Strain and Mondo 2000. While the publishing, quote, empire, close quote, that came to be called Mondo 2000 started in 1984, it really started like so many aspects of Western culture in the 1960s. Although in high school I was there, did we believe in magic? Let's put it this way. There appeared to be a lot of apparent opportunities for a radical transformation, a novel mutation in the human condition. In simple terms, two things seem plausible to idealists: post-scarcity and a global village. Running underneath these prosaic currents was the excitability of youth and the notion that we represented a new sort of human, that we were mutants, freaks. Post-scarcity. In the 1960s, a strand of the vibrant, rising counterculture that was largely situated in the wealthiest and most powerful nation state, and that appeared to be taking on the world, believed it was entering the age of Homo ludens, man at play. If we had enough generosity, enough collectivity, and enough celebratory desire, we can make it happen by the sheer force of generational girth and electrified minds, via drugs or media, or the combination thereof. To our untutored eyes, it appeared that to be such an excess of wealth that we are creating a garbage apocalypse with the overflow. The Haight-Ashbury utopian anarchist The Diggers wrote, "America in 1968 is so incredibly wealthy that the local spiritual crisis is, what are we going to do about the garbage?" They answered that in a world where newly psychedelicized use of the Haight-Ashbury and all across the West were the vanguard of a new, equally distributed leisure class. They created a free store and distributed free food and other stuff in order to model the inevitable new society. In other words, their means for making a new world was do it yourself, do DIY. Not for them, the tiresome slog of leading unionized workers to take control of the means of production. Not for them, dealing with the democratic instrumentalities of the centralized state. Although guaranteed income did smile upon the young from the horizon, and the then welfare state was in a reasonably generous mode, it, not the Diggers, was making our extended post-industrial adolescence possible. DIY would become the primary modality for countercultural activity. From the missionaries of the Whole Earth Catalog and their tools of living, and the punks and their rejection of handed down rock stars and other media expressions in favor of their own cheap and intentionally unprofessional expressions. DIY defined the counterculture approach to the world and our world rejecting across the late 20th century. The attitude would infect the world of early computer hobbyists, and ultimately in the 90s, it would be given a playful, surreal, madcap expression on the pages of Mondo 2000. Whether the world or even the privileged zones of the United States was in or on the verge of post-scarcity, wherein most alienated forms of labor could be jettisoned in favor of a celebratory culture which every man and woman could become a natural artist, not to mention a party animal, was dubious to say the least, and certainly difficult to prove. But one could put on one's futurist cap. Even then, the myth of the quickly approaching and set to explode cyber revolution lurked in utopian dropout imaginations. So I'm gonna stop that there. You got a taste of what I'm trying to put together.
Oh yeah, definitely gave a taste of the vocabulary, the sensorial richness, great expectations that in those years permeated culture, and the clash of pop culture, counterculture, the waves of how counterculture would be adopted by corporate interests, and similarly to how punk became mainstream. Technologies that we would dream about at the end of the 80s now are in the hands of anyone. And from time to time forget that we should feel a profound sense of awe just by seeing that they exist. I want to remind the people following us that at the end of the 80s, we were still very much at the beginning of the personal computer revolution that put this fantastic and magical tool in the hands of millions of people. We were at the beginning of what we now call the internet, where anyone could aim to connect with anyone else, cross-fertilizing ideas and really exposing themselves to the richness of the world's culture. Mondo 2000, for me, represented the yearning to the experimentation that could happen and did indeed happen in many ways in San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, but the rest of the world was ready to go through that kind of experimentation with a lag that not only was already diminishing since then, was completely eliminated, or even now we can find new fashions, new fads, new waves emerging in other places. William Gibson famously wrote his cyberpunk novels in a futuristic Tokyo, imagining that as the center of cyber culture, and maybe not Tokyo, maybe more Seoul in South Korea, or even more Shenzhen in China. But a lot of things that mesmerize us today are coming out from other places. So thank you very much for offering us that glimpse of the book. And I am sure that with the help of your capable agents, a publisher will soon pick it up, and I cannot wait reading it. I actually, in preparation of our chat, looked up the Mondo covers. And those who are not familiar with the magazine can see a little bit of its aesthetic just from the covers already. The components of technology and psychedelics, counterculture, and the tools of empowerment really were always present. I am very happy to see that the women in the cover are not objectified. With our current sensibilities, not only the fact that there are so many, but that they occupy a role of a protagonist and active role rather than being eye candy. So your activities are multifaceted. Let's look at one of your latest creations, which is a usefully paradoxical song available for sale on Bandcamp, both individually and as part of an entire album on a name your price model, where anyone who is courageous enough to offer less than a dollar per song will be cast with some especially powerful negative energy from cyberspace. But I hope that everyone will go and buy either a song or, for not less than $10 or $15, the entire album. So let's listen to I'm Against NFTs.
I'm Against NFTs. It doesn't matter much to me. Every currency has its own sleeves. Follow the birds, not the bees. Scratch that itch until it bleeds. Just for this moment, address our needs. Medical bills, mouths to feed. I'm against NFTs. It doesn't matter much to me. I need a cookie and a cashmere sweater. Strawberry fjords forever. I'm against NFT. And they're against me.
Clever fields forever.
Would you trade a Jeff Koons for a single cruise?
How many tokens for this team?
Get your money worth nothing and your clicks for free. Get your money worth nothing. Clicks for free. Get your money with nothing. And your clicks for free. Get your money with nothing. And your clicks for free. Get your money with nothing. And your clicks for free.
All right, that was fantastic. So, are you? This is a paradoxical song, even more so because, if I am not mistaken, sooner or later, it is going to be available as an NFT, right?
Absolutely. The intention was to create this for an NFT. There will also be a visual NFT, slightly expanded on the same thing, on the same theme, by myself and former Mondo 2000 art director Bart Nagel. So we'll be pulling out the Mondo 2000 name, and that was performed by Mondo Vanilli with the punk rock singer blog Dahlia, and Mondo Vanilli was sort of a subsidiary label of Mondo 2000, via which I wrote and recorded songs with somebody who calls himself Scrappy Duchamp. So, yeah, both those things will be put out as NFTs hopefully pretty soon. I'm hoping within a couple of weeks.
Fantastic, fantastic. Looking forward to it, too. So how do you look at the legacy of Mondo 2000? What from 30 years ago looking at today, you are happy to see that has happened, what you are surprised didn't happen, and what you're surprised that happened and you didn't expect?
Okay, well, I mean, we labeled ourselves a ribbon letter bomb to the core address of consensus reality. And the explosion of consensus reality has been far more unpleasant than I expected it to be. You know, we were looking at it from left libertarian countercultural perspective, that if we exploded the mainline consensus at the time, as we were getting going on this with Mel Brayton and George H.W. Bush, that the many gifts would would come forth. And what we've learned is that many people are not prepared for the explosion of consensus, that it leads to confusion, that the idea that one should destroy or ignore mainstream media was an exaggeration that has not boded well for people who need to hear something that is at least within a fingernail distance of facts, rather than whatever made up stuff they're happy to believe that they find in peculiar nooks and crannies of the internet. So there's that. I mean, our theme was that every man, woman, and other would become a media broadcasting tower. Everyone would have their own media, or every group of people, every collectivity, every creative grouping would have access to sending out their mediated creations to anybody else who happened to have access to the internet. And that's happened, and it's kind of fantastic in many ways. So that has proven to be interesting. We sort of, we're looking at a collaborative, a mechanism for collaboration. And there was kind of a collaborationist ideology that was sort of a soft core version of the anarchist philosophy of mutual aid. And in the view of the early 90s, this didn't require a lot of politics. This was just going to emerge as a property of the new technology, as everybody was able to get online. So, it's just turned out to be much more richly complex and weird than even we thought. I mean, we thought we were weird. And, we used to have a guy who used to write us letters called Xander Karzybski, who had the wildest, what we thought were the wildest conspiracy theories. And we knew Xander, and we never knew, and still don't know, and I don't think he ever knew whether he really believes them or not. And as you know, the kind of schizoculture level that he was operating at. But, you look at something like Q, and, they're outdoing Xander Karzybski, and, they're millions of followers. They're in Dallas waiting for the dead Kennedys to reemerge, the real dead Kennedys, the former president and so forth. So, yeah, reality, you just got bent and warped in ways that were less than pleasant, probably psychedelic. I mean, Doug Rushkoff talks about how the internet has sort of achieved a psychedelic effect, but right now it's kind of a bad trip.
But on the other hand, we are seeing a somewhat surprising new wave for a potential more mainstream acceptance of psychedelics. The legalization of marijuana was the first, but also stronger substances are potentially being declassified at the state level, if not at the federal level in the U.S. What do you attribute this new wave to?
It's amazing to me that in the cultural, social environment that we're in the politically difficult and hostile environment, psychedelics seem to just be sneaking right in through the front door. People have decided that it has great therapeutic value, and it's not really the problem that they once thought it was. And I really don't know where to place this thing, because it's happening in two ways. It's happening through the therapeutic community, and it's also just happening in places like Oakland, where they basically say grow your own, and you know, it's yours. They're literally withdrawing police pressure from psychedelic drugs, you know, as long as they're not instituted in a real commercial way. And then you have the commercial organizations that are, you know, they're out on the stock market now. Peter Thiel, no comment. And, you know, others like that, you know, are actually forming companies to sell psychedelics. It's an interesting thing. I mean, there's the microdosing, which I think is great. I mean, I like all of it. There's an aspect in which I think of Soma. I think of, you know, psychedelics and wild, strong doses were part of a counterculture that was very anti-mainstream. And as Soma, it could be thought of as something that sort of calms the masses and makes everything kind of acceptable, even when it's not. So there's always that danger, which actually is something that Timothy Leary warned about and Abbie Hoffman warned about and a lot of counterculture people warned about. But, you know, I think it's great. I think people need it. People need therapeutic help on a massive level. There appears to be a lot of psychological distress around. I think that's also a product of virtualization.
Actually. And probably or possibly these threads are connected and intertwined. Fragmenting of reality around us can be attributed to technological acceleration exceeding the limits of our adaptability and our ability to interpret reality if we do not understand the agents and the agency that technology is expressing. At the same time, psychedelics put us in touch with how wrong the assumption that reality has a fundamental baseline that we can rely on is, while giving us some confidence in abandoning that assumption and knowing that our relationships, our love for each other, and the desire to build and create do not depend on those assumptions. So that could be one way that these trends exist together.
I think that we're seeing what people think. You know, we used to just sort of see people casually, and you know, maybe if we're hanging out in a bar or watching a ball game on TV or something, people would say something weird, but you could kind of, you'd both smile at each other and you'd shrug it off. And now that is taken away, and we're just seeing precisely what people think. And you know, Sartre said, "Hell is other people," and now I say, "Hell is other people's tweets." So we see what other people think, and we don't like each other. We don't like the way, you know, or we like the way some other people think, and we gather in these groups who are mutuals, and then become very upset. And I think that, I mean, do the right thing has become say the right thing, and mm-hmm. I think there's an insane level of anxiety attached to that.
Do you think that political correctness and social justice expectations have reached their maximum yet? If they have not, to what degree censorship and self-censorship is going to be affecting daily lives of people who don't accept or don't tolerate their own weirdness and the weirdness of others?
I mean, my personal observation is that people in my area seem to be dialing it back a little bit. You know, you can be an asshole about being right, which is something that a lot of people on the left don't understand, but maybe are beginning, some of them, to understand. But, you know, in terms of the sort of waves of anarcho-Stalinism, or, you know, I don't know how to phrase it, the exclusionary, the persecutorial energy, I think it's very related to virtualization, and, you know, mm-hmm. so probably it'll keep on rolling on. This anxiety about saying the right thing or representing the right thing just seems to be an area of real extreme anxiety. And I mean, it could be related to how people are actually living in the real world and the difficulties there. I mean, we were forced virtualized by the pandemic, and I mean, in a really extreme way that we haven't quite sorted out yet, and we're sort of still there to a great degree, and there are more epidemics and problems around that.
We have for a long time assumed almost as an axiom that our digital platforms are eliminating distances, and that the global village is going to be one. Well, yeah. The distances were eliminated, but rather than a global village, it's kind of a global chaos in which our breathing space is necessary in order to keep those we feel are incompatible with us at a distance. What we did,
you know, McLuhan wrote The Global Village and the counterculture embraced that as a utopian notion, but McLuhan himself said that the global village was going to amplify conflicts in every possible way.
That's right. What we maybe didn't expect is that a similar phenomenon would also manifest itself around time. I noticed how it is almost a standard disclaimer on stand-up comedians' specials as they start, you know, telling their jokes. I know in 10 years' time, this is going to be completely unacceptable. But I don't know what to do about it, right? Right. We are starting to understand that our norms are evolving and that we have no ability of realizing at whatever barbaric stage we are. Right. I have a few assumptions around those, right? Today, most of the people are queasy or completely against euthanasia, for example. And I expect in a given amount of time, let's say 10 years, but certainly 50, it is going to be the norm. And there will be many other ways. I expect that with the increasing environmental cost and explicit accounting for the impact of meat, eating meat, cultivated meat, not only is going to be much cheaper, like an order of magnitude cheaper, it is also going to be much richer as an option with Michelin star recipes available from your robot kitchen, but it is also going to be the moral choice, a little bit like especially in the US today, tobacco smoking is more persecuted than pot smoking. Same moral panic is going to aggregate around consumption of animal meat. So there will be very, very interesting evolutions of our moral positions. But even though I gave a couple of examples, most of them will be impossible to anticipate, and they will survive.
There's always the backlash, even if it's a minority, will always be extreme. You see that in the case of gender change and gender fluidity right now. The peculiarity of the hysteria against it and the anxiety for it as well is very high. We'll see backlashes against these shifts. These things ebb and flow also.
You are talking about the digital plane in critical tones, in the sense that they the platforms that brought virtual activities in the forefront and in the mainstream contributed to the fragmentation of our reality. And as a consequence, I'm curious, especially about what you think of the metaverse, both as we were talking about it, 30 years ago through the books of William Gibson or Neil Stephenson, but also what a perversion of those concepts someone like Facebook, now Meta, is trying to push down our thoughts. How do you feel about the current incarnation of the metaverse? Do you expect it will be successful, it will fail, and it in both cases, what will be the reason for its success or its failure?
Yeah, well, I mean, even back in the 90s, we were joking that we would be having the advertisements and the ownership mainlined into our brains, right? I mean, that the far extensive transhuman singularitarian version of that would be actually be downloaded onto the net, but to have our lives owned by a company that charges us rent or feeds us constant advertising feeds. I mean, it's all kind of inevitable. It's all kind of scary, and it's also kind of fun, right? I mean, getting virtual reality available, even if it's through Facebook, there's going to be creative ops there. There are going to be people at play. You know, I talked at the beginning in the reading from my book about man at play. Our play being virtualized and less embodied has its downside and its risks, and it's being owned to a great extent by corporations that has its risks. Now, it's interesting we talk about these large corporations taking cyberspace and leading it into fragmentation, but in a way, they created megastores that brought everybody into the same space. If it had remained independent with billions of websites, it might even be more fragmented now. So I don't know. Life is peculiar and unpredictable. I think the metaverse is trippy and multiplex, and hopefully will not create some kind of a weird monoculture at the end of it. Some kind of Borgian. Semi-Borgian kind of thing. But I mean, it's all rather still up for grabs, even with the imposition of capital and so forth.
What made me realize that if not the current wave, within 3-4 years, we will have a new generation of interfaces that are going to start delivering on at least some of the promise of both augmented reality and virtual reality, which I actually see as a spectrum of a continuity from one extreme to the other, not alternatives in black and white, is the statistic that came out recently that smartphone sales are declining worldwide for Samsung, wow, for Apple. The reason is simple. We all have one, and they are so damn good that as much as they want us, every year we are not going to spend another $1,000 or so for the next model. We will wait longer and longer. We will wait 3-4 years. I actually am not ashamed to admit that I have an iPhone 10. You know, we are now on iPhone 13 and then soon 14. So I was
able. I think mine's a 6, actually.
Oh, there you go. There you go. And Apple is expected next year to come out with a very high-priced $2,000 plus visor, initially mostly for developers, that is going to pave the way for ever more performing and ever cheaper versions once the applications and the user interfaces are there as well. So the fragmentation and the multiplication of ways of looking at the world is going to be supercharged at that point. And I don't know how nation states and the political system and the governance that runs cities, states, and nations is going to cope with that kind of pressure. And whether we should multiply our efforts to prepare and to understand what can we do when the traditional tools are going to be so completely obsoleted by the new tools, which suck us into these disparate realities.
Yeah, well, there seems to be an amplification of nationalisms actually in the midst of all these changes and pressures. And you know, it could be that perhaps that's a very conscious effort to maintain the old guard. Although, I mean, the main establishment, the sort of neoliberal establishment, is very much against the nationalist push. So again, there's a peculiar tug of war going on there. But yeah, the control by nation state. I mean, we thought it would be out of control by now, and nation states really they're pretty strong. They keep on revenating and returning and creating, you know, having power. Precisely the same power that they had before to organize society, but certainly the power to criminalize those which they want to criminalize and try to maintain some form of authority and order. And in many cases, the level of dysfunction created by the distortion of consensus reality justifies the intrusion of the state into so many situations. For example, the internet. I mean, there are very few people who think that the internet should just run wild and free and completely uncensored. Now, many of the same people who were the most adamant about letting anything go, everything goes on the internet, are now most adamant about shutting down particularly ugly vectors of the internet coming from a particular place, actually. But yes, so
metaflux. with your anarchist roots, you are now in a point where you are finding a new balance between a free for all and the necessity of a certain degree of control. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I would guess so. I mean, I always dial back to the position that I don't take a position. As an absurdist, you know, as a trickster doing a NFT against NFTs, or a pro NFT against NFTs thing, I always prefer to be in the Warholian position of just letting myself be a blank slate upon which people can project whatever they wish. But I do accept being interviewed, and then I start giving opinions, and then I end up in trouble.
in that sense, to be able to interpret the zeitgeist really means being as devoid of preconceptions as possible, and then absorbing, collecting, and then reflecting, both in terms of giving back, but also in terms of having analyzed and having re-elaborated what the world is messaging to you. And that is a very precious and unique position.
Yeah, I also want to add that, I mean, we utopians of the 1980s and 1990s, most of us, the majority of us were North Americans, we were Caucasians, and we were men. And the utopian we hoped for hasn't come true, but the world has come in. And it's a great opportunity and movement of communication by and throughout the rest of the world that was excluded from the early days of the internet. So that's one of the great things about the current situation. I mean, you know, the Black Twitter, what's called Black Twitter, is one of the cleverest and most amusing and most artistic areas on the internet now. So these things have changed. So us old fogies can kind of look and go, geez, it didn't turn out the way we wanted it to. But there's this other incursion that's also positive going on.
So in order to check out the Mondo 2000 History Project, people can go on the web on mondo2000.com. And they can also follow 2000_Mondo on Twitter. I am sure that they will enjoy that greatly. Rather than showing here the somewhat longish URL of the song homepage where it can be bought, I invite our viewers to go there from Twitter, because it is linked on Twitter and they will find it easily. So any parting words to our viewers, what would you like them to do as they listen to your Dadaistic absurdist memories, but also discover the gems of wisdom in them?
Well, I mean, I do hope people go to my Bandcamp, look up Are You Serious Bandcamp, and there's lots of weird stuff on there and brilliant music. I have to credit the musicians. You know, they're not fooling around. They're not just amateurs. They're actually, it's real music going on there. So, yeah, come to Mondo2000.com and keep an eye out for Freaks and the Machine.
Freaks and the Machine. We will certainly going to be reading it either eagerly as soon as it is out. And in the meantime, I thank you for the snippet that you read us. I'm going to say goodbye to our viewers now, but please stay on so that I can say goodbye to you personally as well. Thank you very much for watching this episode of Searching for the Question with Are You Serious, founder and editor of Mondo 2000, lyricist and writer. I was really excited to have him on the show. I hope you liked it as well. And I'm looking forward to welcome you at the next episode of Searching for the Question. Goodbye.